you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us this month to talk about Marvel Treasury Edition number 20, The Rampaging Hulk, is returning guest and fellow network all-star, Max Romero. Hi, Max. Welcome back.
Hello, puny human. I'm happy to be here. Max Smash.
Thank you so much for coming back. I really appreciate it. I always enjoy talking to you, and the Hulk, for some reason on this show, has been generally criminally underserved by my guests. I don't know why. When, you know, as I mentioned a couple of months ago, we're in the final year of the show, and I have a checklist of the treasuries that I want to get to before we wrap up, and we won't get to be able to get to every single one of them, but I'm going to do the best job I can. But when I was, you know, crossing off the covers, like I did this one. There's like four Hulks left. Now, part of it is Hulk got a lot of treasuries, especially near the end. Marvel was just like Spider-Man Hulk at the Olympics, Spider-Man Hulk. They just went back and forth. So there were more Hulks to get to. But nevertheless, I felt like the Hulk really deserved, more treasury love on this show. So I'm glad you were willing to talk about Hulk treasury with me. Now, why did you want to pick two questions for you? Why'd you pick this one? Because there were other ones to pick. And then what is your, if you have any, history with the Hulk growing up? Did you read him a lot? Did you not? Like, what's your, you and the Hulk, what's your relationship?
Oh, boy. Okay. So we'll start with why I picked this one. The cover is amazing. it's my chocolate and peanut butter. I mean, it is the Hulk and Dr. Doom. And how is that not appealing to every comic book nerd ever? And it's just, it's a wonderful cover. It's, you know, it's, of course, it's the Hulk doing his kind of like screaming at the sky, no,
as
pose.
As he does, yeah.
As he does. And then it's the I don't know what we would call that, but it basically it's the image of Doom's shoulders and head looking down at the Hulk, you know, in that way that Dr. Doom does, and everything is destruction. And okay, so I grew up, my comic book or my superhero trio, my trinity was, you know, and you just said it, it was Superman, it was Spider-Man, and the Hulk. And a lot of that was because of TV, you know. So when I was young, I was exposed to Superman because, you know, Superman everywhere.
How could you not be? Yeah.
And but also because of reruns of The Adventures of Superman, you know. And so I used to watch those all the time. And Spider-Man, you know, of course, had there were reruns of also of his 60s cartoon, and he was also on and this used to thrill me to bits. He was on the Electric Company.
Oh yeah, sure.
And that was my whole thing, was trying to catch Spider-Man on the Electric Company and the Hulk. And of course, you know, the Hulk had his own TV show, and I was a big fan of that. So, you know, those kind of overlapped over the years and really kind of just solidified my love for those three heroes, especially at that age. And the Hulk, rereading this, and we'll get it, and I know we'll get into it. Rereading this made me remember what I loved about the Hulk, because I had been off the Hulk for a long time. I had kind of lost interest in the character. I was bored, I guess, with the direction that he was going in modern times, that the writers were taking him in. And I don't know, it just wasn't appealing to me anymore. But reading this reminded me of what it was that I used to love about the Hulk so much. So this treasury for me was a real joy to read. It kind of sparked something in me that I had not felt for this character for a long time.
Well, that's wonderful. That's a great thing. That's a great thing to say about this comic book. Yeah, it is kind of hard to beat the combo of like Hulk and Doctor Doom because you're trying to think what hero villain combo have less to say to each other, right? Because you've got the Doom who is like as a villain verbose, and he's always trying to like kind of like outthink his opponents because of course he's always taking on Reed Richards and sometimes Spider-Man, but you know, here he's just taking on a guy who's Hulk smash. You know, he's like, what else does he have to say to this guy? Now, of
And
course,
he's a scientific genius, and the Hulk is, not
not yeah.
so.
Now, and of course, on the upper left of the cover, and of course, we'll have a gallery section for this issue. It says Marvel's TV sensation in about the biggest blurb they could stick on there without it covering up more, you know, really too much of the cover real estate. So that's clearly what it was, is that, yeah, by this point, the Treasury editions were basically just the house organ for their two most popular characters, which were Spider-Man and Hulk. Because as we'll talk about, you know, contra like some other collections that we've done where, oh, it's a trade paperback. They took four issues and they of a storyline and they slot, you know, slammed it together and they made a little trade paperback of it. Or it's more of a greatest hits package where it's like the Spider-Mans are like one Ditko story, one Romita story, one Gil Kane maybe. And it's a, you know, it's a sample platter of Spider-Man. This is not that. This is kind of just neither fish nor fowl. It's two issues and then two more issues that are separated for no really great reason. Dr. Doom is not a particularly foe of the Hulk in any way. So you're kind of like, well, why are they doing this? And it really is just, hey, we want to sell some treasuries and the Hulk sells comics. So let's put to another Hulk treasury. Now, you read the Hulk comic, I assume. Did you also read Marvel Superheroes as well? Because I read both. I love the Hulk is one of my favorite Marvel comics. And I read both because obviously Marvel Superheroes was reprinting old Hulks that had long ago been published. So I was like, hey, I get Hulk twice a month. This is great.
I wasn't, because I didn't have a regular source for comics.
Oh.
I was really kind of beholden to whatever the convenience store nearby had. And so I but like the like you're saying, the Hulk was popular, so the Hulk I think was always on the newsstand in some way.
Yeah.
And so that was a little easier to get, or a little more reliable, I guess, to get. But yeah, in my early days, none of my comics matched up. None of them. There were no sequences. There were no follow-up. It was very rare for me to get more than, say, two or three issues in a row.
Oh man.
Yeah,
Oh.
I don't know who was doing the buying at that store, but yeah, it was all over the place.
I guess I'll get Richie Rich billions this month. I don't know. That's fine.
You know what? I don't know why those Richie Rich were like the easiest things to get.
See,
Richie Rich and Archie were always there.
there are books on Harvey Comics. I've read one of them. Mark Arnold, the author Mark Arnold, wrote a book about Harvey Comics, and I read it. But he didn't get into that because I just probably that information is lost to time. But there is a story out there for
Oh,
some
God.
intrepid comics historian of how the hell Richie Rich supported 44 titles a month. They've been talking about it over at Batman Family Reunion every month. And it's a running gag across the network and across any comics fan of a certain vintage of just how, who was buying these books? Who
It
was
is
the, you know?
insane. It is
Yeah.
insane. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
But
I read my fair share of Richie Rich because they were always there.
yeah. And to tie it back to the Hulk, Ernie Colon drew both characters. He drew the Hulk at a certain point and he drew Richie Rich. So there you go. So, okay. By the way, I should mention the cover is that Max has been complimenting is by Bob Budiansky and Jack Abel. Right. So, yeah, it's a very nice cover. Hulk's raging at the heavens, and we're seeing what's going to happen here. The Power of Doom is the headline. Now, of course, the subtitle is The Rampaging Hulk, which is borrowed from the Black and White magazine, which I absolutely loved. It has nothing to do with the magazine. This is a reprint from the magazine. They just were like, look, we already did Incredible Hulk. What else could we do? All right, about rampaging. All right, that's fine. We'll do Rampaging Hulk. So the
Yeah.
first, yeah.
No, I was gonna say, and see, and I read I used to read the Hulk magazine.
Oh, I did too. I loved it.
Yeah, and because I think if I'm remembering correctly, you could find that in bookstores. And or
Okay.
at least I seem to remember finding them in bookstores. And so yeah, for some reason I read the Hulk magazine fairly often. I mean, fairly consistently. So that's where a lot of my Hulk content came from, which was thrilling for me because, you know, it's a little more, it's a little more geared toward adults.
Yeah, a little
So,
bit. I love the Hulk magazine. I absolutely
yeah.
love Rampaging Hulk. It's great. So,
Right.
okay. So the first story is classic Marvel title. Klaatu, the behemoth from beyond space. Absolutely fantastic. It's from Hulk number 136. It's by Roy Thomas, who is back in the news for some reason nowadays.
Yeah. Well, you know, I heard he came up with the Hulk. I think he, I didn't he originate
Oh, Lord.
that?
Herb Trimpe and Sal Buscema. Now, before we even start talking about this story, again, I didn't do plot synopses. We're just going to talk about what we liked about these books because I 90 episodes in, I'm tired of writing plot synopses. I'm not doing it anymore. But I absolutely love the top half of this first page of the plane above the title of the story. There's just something so dynamic about the way Herb Trimpe is laying that out. I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to oversell it, but there's just something so cool about this plane with no panel borders. It's just kind of flying through white space over this logo. It just seems very exciting. It just like, oh boy, I don't know what's going to happen. This it looks fun though.
Yeah, it has movement, you know, it has dynamism to it. And I like that, like you're saying, it was at it's at the very top. There's no background. You know, it's just this plane that I don't know why is obviously, you know, in flight. And then you get the title, and then you get you know, you get Ross and you get this guy whose name I cannot remember,
Glenn Talbot.
Talbot, Glenn Talbot, and Bruce, and they're in the plane, which is like pretty swanky plane. That looks like better than some apartments I've had. And it just works really well. It transitions really well into the scene.
I love that they don't give Bruce a shirt, right? He's just sitting there in his purple pants, bare chested. Like they don't have a spare shirt to give this guy, but okay. So we're picking up the story as usual with Hulk in medias res. Where he's been picked up by General Ross and they're flying him back because they're gonna, you know, of course, try and help him out, stop him from being the Hulk. But as you might imagine, he starts stressing out, he starts flipping out. I love that they're, you know, they wait until he starts going, oh God, oh Lord, to then go get the hypo needle they're gonna knock out. Like they couldn't imagine this might happen, you know,
Right.
like this is only the 95th time. This has happened, but they try and, you know, they're like trying to calm him down, but it doesn't work. He turns into the Hulk. He jumps out of this giant plane and the whole thing crashes into the city. And then the Hulk jumps out of it. And I mean, it's like you just think about the destruction,
Yeah.
right? That would have been wreaked in just these couple of panels that in a battleship sized helicopter has just crashed under the streets of New York, and you know, like Hulk stops the plane from crashing all the way, and then he just walks away. Like it's another day in the Marvel Universe.
You know, and I want to know how he managed to hit the ground before the helicopter did.
I know.
And then what I love about it, and this is, see, this is my Ur Hulk, you know, this is my pure Hulk right here, is that he comes down, he busts out, I mean, he literally like punches a hole in the side of this falling helicopter, lands on the ground, sees the helicopter falling, and immediately assumes that it's out to hurt him. This helicopter is an enemy. And he says, well, Hulk won't let it, and he catches it and saves everybody on the helicopter, and but you know, knocks over a car on his way out. So that to me is just that that's what I paid my Hulk money for.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. That's what you plunked down your quarter in 1974 for. So the Hulk runs away. He makes like King Kong where he climbs up a building. Then we have this interlude in outer space featuring a character named Zeron the Star Slayer, who I don't know, no offense to Herb Trimpe, this is not, you know, I don't know, there's a reason why Zeron the Star Slayer didn't go on to, I think, a really great career in the Marvel Universe or anything like that. But he runs across the Hulk. They start getting into a fight. And then this giant being, this Klaatu, the behemoth from Beyond Space that we mentioned, sort of emits from this ship that the alien is flying around in. There's a blackout across the city. And of course, there just leads to a giant battle between Hulk and this creature. And it's just really this knockdown, drag-out fight between the three of them sort of on the streets of New York City until we get to Hulk gets knocked out. He gets brought up to this to Zeron's ship, and we see there is a bunch of alien captives in there, and one of the people working for Zeron is, of course, the Abomination, because why wouldn't it be? And that's the end of our first issue. So, I mean, what do you think of this as a story, Max?
You know, at first I was kind of like, okay, it's going to be Hulk versus a giant monster kind of thing, which it is, but the writing feels so early, you know, early Marvel. It feels so Stan Lee.
Yeah.
That it is fun. I mean, like that first image, go back to that first image again of the plane. You know, the first line is the wings of man. And then it goes into this whole thing about Icarus, and you know, it's crazy. But it's like you said, I kind of like that we're just kind of dropped into this, that you don't know quite what's happening. You know that they picked up Banner somewhere else and they're bringing him back to the States. And, you know, he sees New York and that's when he starts to lose it. And I don't know why they decided they needed to take him to like the most populous city in the United States.
Take him to Utah or something. What do you
mean? Yeah, exactly. Take him back to New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They can jump around there all he wants. But I like that it has, the art has a very, you know, and this is Trimpy, but it still has a very Herbie kind of look to it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the designs look very Kirby-ish, you know, and I don't understand, I guess, some things. I don't really know why they were put in there. I don't know, like, why the Russians were put in there, except to put us in the place where we can see the alien ship. Zeron is kind of a zero, I guess. You know, he doesn't really impress much.
He looks like he's made up of parts from other villains.
Yeah. You
know, like a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Right. You know, and the bad guys are floating around in ships with solar ores, I guess, to move around.
Sure.
You know, but I still find the whole thing kind of charming. The writing is very much of that time. You know, it's a lot of exposition. It's a lot of, you know, saying, hey, look at that. You know, and you can kind of see what's happening, but they're still going to explain it to you. And Klaatu, okay, how do you feel about Klaatu? Because to me, he looks kind of like a catfish with legs. but I still kind of like him for some reason. But I don't. They sell him as more of a threat than he looks like, even though that kind of changes as it goes on because, you know, we'll talk about that, you know, when we get to the second part.
He looks a little like a blobfish.
Yeah.
Kind of. And so, yeah, he's certainly imposing. I mean, he's like he's the entire height of, I think, what is supposed to be the Empire State Building. So, I mean, that means he's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet tall. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's just kind of a, he doesn't have like a whole lot of personality.
Yeah.
And he's dispensed with he doesn't feature into the fight all that much. I think a lot of it is just to get him up, get the Hulk knocked out into the spaceship where he's going to meet the Abomination. Because of course that's your marquee character.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think this issue itself is fine. But it's really all set up for the next issue.
Yep.
And I think if I had read this issue without being able to immediately go into the next one, I probably would have felt like, I don't know if that would have been enough to sell me on the rest of the story.
Okay, fair enough. We'll get to the second story now. But one thing I want to mention before we get to this is if you look on the cover of this book and you look at the bottom right cover, and there is a very, very tiny plankton-sized type. It says, in a little box, Mr. Retailer, for display announcement, see page 20. Ooh, what does that mean? So you go to page 20, and you look down at the very, very bottom, and it says, announcement to all magazine retailers. Marvel Comics Group is pleased to announce a retail display program for Marvel Treasury. Under this program, participating retailers will receive a display allowance of 10% of the cover price per every copy sold, yada, yada, yada. Now, I don't know if they mean that. Okay, the reason I'm bothering to mention this is because, as I have mentioned in previous episodes, I'm obsessed with, like, the how these books were sold. There was a DC Comics devoted Treasury box that they sent to retailers that I will not rest until I find. Like, I've seen pictures of it. I've never seen it in real life. I've never seen it on an eBay, but I, you know, I'm hoping it still exists. So when I see this and they say they get the word display in there, does that mean Marvel sent dedicated displays for the Treasuries? And it was like, hey, Mr. Retailer, by the way, it should be Mr. or Mrs. Retailer, but okay, Mr. Retailer, if you use these displays, you're going to get an additional couple of cents on every book sold. Is that what that means? I don't really know, but I like to think that it does. And I love the idea that Marvel made some dedicated Treasury displays that they sent out to newsstands, because now that's another thing I have to hunt down.
Yeah, I don't know. I have never seen anything like that?
No, I never have either.
But that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yep. Yeah. No, right. And I may be using the word display interchangeably. It could be, they could just be saying, hey, if you give these books prominent placement in your newsstand, and we can maybe verify that, like, it's a program that you're going to sign up for and you're going to promise to do these things. Because as we all know, the newsstand distribution system was honor system at best. So I don't know. But I mean, I just love that idea that maybe Marvel was doing that, because like I said, I'm obsessed with store displays. I mean, there's a reason why I have a spinner rack in the very room that I'm recording this in.
Which I'm very jealous of, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I you know what? I can appreciate that, because I love the thing. I really do love the thing. So, you know, if any of you out there listening knows what that little indication means, let me know, because I'm fascinated by it. So, okay. So the next story is the next issue of Hulk 137. It's The Stars, Mine Enemy. Oh, Roy Thomas is so highfalutin. It's by Roy Thomas, Herb Trimpe again, and this time the inker is Mike Esposito.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think Roy Thomas is really, at least in this one, I'd have to go back and check other things to be sure, but he really makes a lot of literary references.
Oh, he does, yes.
You know, because, like, I'm just going to spoil it now, this whole story is basically a retelling of Moby Dick at this point. And the Stars My Enemy sounds a lot like The Stars My Destination.
Yes, it does. Yes,
you know, by Alfred Bester.
Yeah.
And then in the next story, he mentions William Faulkner.
He makes a reference to William Faulkner. I love how highfalutin Roy Thomas could get sometimes. It's really, really funny. I had not thought about that. This is like a Moby Dick thing. Yeah. It really is, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Wow. Laser harpoons and everything.
Yeah. I mean, it opens with just a bunch of pages of Hulk and Abomination beating the crap out of each other, which you always want to see, because it's I always love the Abomination. You know, fun design. But yeah, you're right, because it is basically the Hulk becomes part of this ship of aliens. Like, you just like, they, but there's a scene where he's on like a bunk. He's like like his own bunk, you know.
Yeah, he's basically press ganged into being on this crew. Yeah. And the whole point is that the captain is, you know, they're in orbit around Earth because they're waiting for Klaatu to come out of hiding, where he's hiding in the power grid, I believe. He's like somewhere in the electricity. And so they're basically waiting for him to show, but it's essentially a whaling ship. You know? And they're waiting for their Moby Dick to break the surface so they can harpoon him and take him down. And it's totally Moby Dick.
It really is. I can't without all the whale blubber diversions, but yeah, it really is what it is. And then, so then we get another villain, Cyborg, who is a half man, half robot. And once again, it is, I enjoy these stories. They're a lot of fun, but in terms of villain creation, I think Roy Thomas was really maybe running a little thin on inspiration, because these are kind of just, again, like sort of parts of other characters, other villains, right, sort of smooshed together and to hopefully to make something new. Because when they get to this reveal of Cyborg, he gets a full page.
Yeah, they really build it up. Yeah,
and you're just kind of like, oh, well, all right. You know, like, it's just not that, really. Does he deserve a full page, you know, of reveal? I don't know. Maybe I'm being too harsh.
Yeah, well, no, isn't there a DC villain like that? Like one of the Fateful Five, isn't
he? Yes, yeah, one of the right? Fateful Five. Is good. That's right.
You know, so yeah, it's kind of like, I've seen this, but okay. Yeah. They make a big deal about how horrifying this is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, yeah, I mean, it looks cool. I mean, it's very Kirby-esque again, you know, but it's, I wouldn't say it's horrifying necessarily.
No. I will say, art-wise, though, I love the sequence where Klaatu drifts into the sun.
Yes.
And it's all just a series of panel, the same size panels as he drifts further and further. Like, you know, these Hulk stories, as most Marvel comics were then and probably still are now, as you mentioned, like just full of bombast. You know, everything is right. 4 exclamation marks and everything is the greatest saga you've ever read. And I mean, it's all hyperbole. And so once in a while, when you do something quiet, it stands out. And I love that for 2/3 of this page, we don't get any word balloons.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's just as Klaatu slowly drifts into the sun, like it's just a nice little like, okay, we can just take a breather here before things get crazy. And then it ends with this very Roy Thomas poetic-y ending of a boy and his child looking into the stars and seeing
right, 2 shooting stars, which are actually, I guess, the Hulk and the Abomination hitting the atmosphere. But yeah, it's yeah, I do really like because they're very horizontal, thin panels.
Yep.
And, you know, and Cyborg, who, because they, Zeron and Cyborg both, use their harpoons to weaken, Klaatu, and, Cyborg somehow ends up on the back of Klaatu, and Zeron cuts his line, to save the rest of the people on his boat. And that's when we see them, that's when we see Klaatu and Cyborg both kind of just silently drift into the sun. And we kind of see there's a little bit of a indication of flames, you know, mm-hmm. of them hitting the sun, and, you know, of just them burning up on the way in. And it works really well. And again, you know, it's a total Moby Dick reference. You know, Cyborg is his Ahab, and he goes down with his whale. And I think that's really well done. And like you're saying, you know, there's a lot of bombast, there's a lot of frilly language being used, but I'm glad that there was some restraint with that,
mm-hmm.
because it really could have gone over the top, but I think it works so much better as just silent, as an almost like a reverence from the characters themselves as they lose their captain, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Cyborg is the one who, you know, at the end he says, while we who were the co-authors of revenge have fallen into an internal orbit around that self-same sun, because, you know, that's just how people talk, an ellipse which shall endure long after our meager air shield has faded into nothingness. Aye, we shall be Cyborg's sole mourners, our vessel his only monument. You know, that is kind of a great epitaph for a character who we were only introduced to a few pages ago.
Yeah. Yeah, you could imagine the I can't believe this is terrible podcasting where you can't think of a word. You would think that the Marvel House style would be, let's put a bunch of captions over these
mm-hmm. panels
because mm-hmm. we can't. And no, they decided not to do that. And so that stuck out to me when I reread this. I was like, oh yeah, that's just again, I don't want to oversell it, but it's just kind of a nice when you've got just page after page of smash, bah, bah, you know, and mm-hmm. then you're just like, oh, here's this nice little quiet ending. Like, okay,
yeah,
cool. All right.
Yeah. Especially this issue is full of a bunch of chatty Cathys. I mean, Abomination won't shut up. Cyborg just goes on and on. You know, it's, I don't want to say shocking, but it is like you said, it's notable in mm-hmm. in what is a very cocky comic.
Yep. Overall, it's a nice one or two parter. Again, neither of these villains outside of the Abomination, who of course is an all timer, but none of these villains are particularly memorable. You know, they're not. I don't know if they've ever come back. I doubt it. Yeah, they're but it, again, as an adaptation of Moby Dick, it's fairly clever. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, come on, how many kids at this point have read Moby Dick, really?
Right, and I can say that I liked this story the more it went on.
Hmm.
Which is looking at it, you would not think that would be the case, but yeah, for some reason, it kind of sold me at the end.
All right, well, good on you, Marvel Comics, for pulling these out of the archives and putting them in the treasury. So, okay, next up is, as you mentioned earlier, Sanctuary from Hulk number 143 by Roy Thomas. This time, the art team is Dick Ayers and John Severin. And you mentioned it says there's a little asterisk next to the title, and then it says with apologies to William Faulkner. And I love how humble braggy that is of Roy Thomas, right? Because it's like, look, it's just one word. You know what I mean? Like, other people have used the word sanctuary. I mean, you know, it's from the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to. And it's only Roy Thomas is like, well, I should mention that I've read William Faulkner.
Yes,
so for all you people reading Hulk comics, I've read William Faulkner. You know, and you're like, okay, Roy, calm down. You know, I mean, all right, that's fine. But it's just like, you know, you really went out of your way to. It's like those people that are like, I went to Harvard. Like, okay, I didn't ask. You know,
right, right. You know, and I can tell you, that actually made me go to Wikipedia and look up the book. No ties at all. Has absolutely nothing to do with Faulkner.
Roy, come on. What are we doing here?
Yes. Sit down, Roy.
Yeah. Art-wise, I am a monster fan, no pun intended, of John Severin from his Cracked days, from his Hulk days. Like, you wouldn't think he would fit on Hulk, but he does. And so he's only doing the inking here, but he's a very powerful inker. And I think Dick Ayers is certainly a fine artist, but not one I would say that came to anything with a really super definable style. You know, right. I think only the most diehard comic book art aficionados, like say Chris Franklin, would be able to like pick out a Dick Ayers drawing. It's not like, it's not Jack Kirby, it's not Steve Ditko. You know, you look at a Ditko and you're like, that's nobody else do that. But Dick Ayers, I think, had a more kind of just, forgive this word, generic style as a penciler. And so Severin really gets to bring his flavor to it. And I just love it. I absolutely love it. And this is the first story where it leads into the Hulk getting paired up with Doc Samson, a character who I love for no good reason. Right? I love when he shows up. He's ridiculous looking. He's got the long green hair. He's got that costume. He's never done anything all that cool that I can point to that makes me love him so much. But every time he shows up in a Hulk comic, I'm like, ah, it's Doc Samson having to see here. And then he gets introduced to Dr. Doom. And of course the Hulk gets wrapped up in his plot by Dr. Doom. But I don't know. I love this one, but again, partly just because it's John Severin doing the art.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's, when I first got to it, I was a little disappointed actually with the art because of that generic nature that you mentioned, you know, it, and especially coming from Trimpy, who is, you know, so well known for his Hulk work. And it's, you know, but as it went on, I guess something clicked and I saw how it worked. I saw, you know, those Severin inks, how they really come through. And I have to say, I really enjoy the depiction of Doom in this story. I really kind of like the way Doom comes across.
How so? Do you like it when he yells at his underling? Silence, dog!
Oh my god, he says he loves his people, but man, he is so rough on him. I think what I like is how you can get so much facial expressions out of an iron mask. it's just really well done. His eyes are almost always popping out of his... out of his skull. That metal mouth is always open to shout at somebody or threaten somebody. And you know, the body language on, you know, on page 45, he's looking out a window and he's kind of leaning against the curtain that he's holding open, and he has one hand on his hip. You know, it's just, it just looks, it's a fun Doom, you know, it's, and you kind of get the sense, I mean, and this is more the writing, but I mean, I think the body language helps, is that this is a Doom, and it's mentioned somewhere in the story that he's only been ruling the country for a little more than 5 years. You know, cause he says, oh, you know, a little more than half a decade, which is, you know, not long. And, you know, but you kind of get this sense of like, okay, this is a guy who can just like kind of waltz in and take over a small country just on brains, sociopathy, and
his manipulation of the Electoral College. We all know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, they called him Hanging Chad back in college. And look it up, kids. And they, you know, but it's, you know, he is an authoritarian, you know, top to bottom. And, you know, that is not something to admire, obviously. But when it comes,
you listening, everybody,
but when it comes from such a diva, you know, it's something I can appreciate from, you know, the safe distance of a comic book.
Yes. And Dr. Doom can be very charming, right? As you said, from the remove of a Marvel comic.
Right. Okay. And, you know, and I have to say too, I also have this weird love for Doc Samson. I don't know what it is.
I don't know.
I don't know why. I think it's because he looks like a pulp hero.
Is that what it? Yeah, I've always loved this character, and there's no justification for it.
And you know, and to be honest, it makes me a little mad. And I have a question about this too. That he has a haircut in this issue. So is he's got more of like a Dutch boy cut, which I don't like.
No, I like I like letting his freak flag fly.
Exactly.
You know. Yeah.
But that gives him a chance to say that somehow his strength is actually connected to his hair, like Samson, which I've never heard of before.
Yeah, what is that a thing? Who wrote this? Bob Haney? What is that about? Yeah, never knew that. I guess I liked it just because he was a guy that could at least fight Hulk on some level. I mean, he always got his ass handed to him because Hulk is the strongest one there is. But he could at least fight him a little bit. But yeah, he's so goofy.
Yeah.
That costume is so goofy, and I don't know, but yeah, every time I've seen him, I was like, I dig this guy, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like there's some, oh, well, that's from the great Doc Samson run. Like, what are you talking about? That's not a thing.
I do like that. Every time he fights the Hulk, he's spending half his time going, Hulk, please.
You know? Just doesn't learn. I love that the last page of the story is the cover. Now, obviously, it's the other way around, that Buddy Yansky borrowed off this page and recreated it for himself. But you've got the same thing here, where it's Doom is flying the flag, and he's like saying, and you, the rampaging Hulk, shall lead them a charred and simmering ruin. And you're like, all right, I'll definitely buy the next issue. This is very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great splash page. Yeah, it's a great splash page. You know, and it made me wonder a little bit where Latveria is actually supposed to be, because I mean, it's obviously sort of Eastern European, but they also use German when they address Doom. You know, they kind of say Herr Doom. So I'm one of those questions. I'm sure someone out there knows, but I do not. I don't know where Latveria is exactly.
Yeah, and it's Latveria sort of courtesy the Universal horror movies.
Right.
Of the 40s, where
it's
like, well, this is 1975 or four, and yet the technology outside of Doom is like they're all using like hand carts and stuff. You know, you're like, wait, what is this? What's going on?
Yeah, you can see Frau Brücke in the background.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, totally. So then we jump right into the part two of the story, which is called The Monster and the Madmen, Hulk 144, next issue. Same creative team, Roy Thomas. This time we've got Gary Friedrich. Partly listed as co-writer with Dick Ayers and John Severin doing the artwork. And it opens with a battle of Hulk and versus Iron Man. And there's this page, the second panel, because they're looking at this, they're watching this film, and their General Ross is showing everybody this battle that took place between Hulk and Iron Man. First of all, Hulk looks like he is 20 feet tall compared to Iron Man, which is funny because he's not that tall. But the way he is holding Iron Man it really, you're like, how did he not rip Iron Man in half? Right?
Yeah.
Like Iron Man is so helpless that you're like, what?
You know, the thing that seems to save people half the time with this version of the Hulk is the Hulk just gets bored. He just says like, oh, forget it. And he walks off because, yeah, he looks like he is about to tear into like a rotisserie chicken. And
exactly.
I don't know how. Yeah, I mean, he's got one hand on an ankle and another hand on a bicep and he's about to make a wish. It does not look good for Tony.
Yeah. Like, I don't care what armor he's got. He's going to just pop Iron Man's arms out of his socket. It's really kind of scary in its own way. And then we go back to Dr. Doom, and we are reintroduced to Valeria, his great love, who looks a lot like Zatanna.
Yeah,
sort of in the early period Justice League. I have to say, not early period. That would be the Top Hat and Tails look, but the mid period, the 70s one, where she looked like a custom of her model Sindela. But and you know, I like that, you know, Valeria can't quite figure out how evil her love Dr. Doom is. You know what I mean? Like, she's sort of constantly like giving him side eye of like, what are you doing, Doom? He's like, well, he's, you know, come on, he's clearly,
But I love that Doom is always kind of like nothing.
Yeah, no, it's just.
Don't worry, everything's fine. Everything's fine. I think she like she knows, but she doesn't want to admit it, I guess. But boy, she gives Doom a lot of rope. You know, I kind of like this. You know, I have to admit, this is maybe the first time that I've really gotten to see this relationship in any kind of real fashion, I guess. And I kind of like how it's very much a love-hate relationship where, you know, she understands that he is evil and, you know, up to no good, but she can't help it. She can't help but love him. And he knows that he is evil and up to no good, but man, does he just love Valeria. And it's this thing that it's, you know, oof, no, I almost said it. I didn't. I'm not going to say it. It's something that is never going to work. but you know, you can see that both of them wish it could. You know, and I don't know. It's but there's a panel on page 61, which is the third panel on that page, and we're still getting kind of. This is after Banner has been brainwashed basically into being a loyal citizen of Latveria. And Doom is arguing with Valeria, and he is so mad that he like raises his arms up and shakes his fist because he's just so frustrated. You know, and he says, why do you bait me thus, girl, beyond the point of madness? And you know, it's like, look, anyone who's been in a relationship, they know where Doom's coming from.
Can this marriage be saved? I do like that he's shaking his fist, though. I love that the most, like, arguably outside of Galactus,
right,
the ultimate villain of the Marvel Universe is Dr. Doom. And even he is so frustrated with games, you know, that he's just like, doesn't matter how powerful you are. Happy wife, happy life. You know, I mean, that's just what it is. So I just really love it. It's there's some really nice coloring too. I have to mention there's on page 67 where there's this explosion outside the window that him and Valeria are looking out of, and there's this wonderful lighting effect.
Yeah,
on Doom's mask, like that looks really nice. Again, there's something about the way Severin is inking this. I find it to be just very, very charming. Who's the colorist here? It says. Actually, it doesn't list the colorist. It just lists the letter already sent him. So I don't know who colored this, but it's really, really quite nice. And then there's a different, not related to that, but just art-wise. On page 71, there's a panel where Hulk punches two Doom's henchmen. And one of them, he punches in the head. Yeah. And I have to assume that the Hulk is pulling his punch because the guy still has a head after that. You know? I'm like, you just got punched. A, by a fist the size of a cinder block, And two, it's the Hulk. And three, you're just a regular dude.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Just a henchman. They're not superpowered in any way. So the Hulk is really constantly pulling his punches for how much of a monster he is billed as. He's always, you know,
right,
keeping himself under check.
Yeah. I mean, there is, I don't remember what comic, Planet Hulk, maybe one of those more recent Hulk comics, where they mentioned that for all the destruction that the Hulk is responsible for, his body count is actually very low because he tries not to kill anybody. And, you know, this is the evidence right here, because these guys should just be like a fine red mist. There's no way that Hulk doesn't just, like, you know, destroy these people. But yeah, they're, you know, they just kind of, like, you know, they fall back, like if, you know, Daredevil had hit them, you know, not, you know, this you know, big green guy. And yeah, I mean, he's again, Hulk just wants to be left alone. You know, he didn't ask to be kidnapped by Dr. Doom, which I guess we should mention, though, this whole convoluted plot of Doom's is basically to use the Hulk as a WMD and Banner to create a gamma bomb to threaten everyone else with. That's the crux of the plot. Am I right about that?
Yeah,
right?
It's not a bad plan. It's Dr. Doom, yeah. Plans go.
yeah. No, it makes sense. Yeah, and you know, but that's where the whole thing comes from. And you know, I gotta, you know, give it up to Roy Thomas. He managed to get two issues out of that, you know, and two issues that make sense. I don't think, it doesn't feel padded anywhere to me.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. You know, I'm as a reader, I'm kind of invested in what's going on. And I think it's interesting that, like a lot of Hulk stories from this period, the Hulk is kind of just a victim of circumstance. You know, he's not necessarily looking for this trouble. It comes looking for him. And really, he's just mad that someone is screwing with his life.
Which is most of us at this point, right? You know?
Yeah. I appreciate that.
And at the end, where Hulk puts Dr. Doom in a bear hug, and he's going to crush him. And we have that ending that you mentioned where he finally says, Hulk goes, "Don't talk, just go," before Hulk changes his mind. Which is great. Hulk just gets bored. But I absolutely love the panel, that last panel on page 75 of Dr. Doom on his knees.
Yeah.
Looking very supine to the Hulk. Like, that's, we don't see Doom in that position very often, where he looks small. And it's really well done by Dick Ayers and Dick Ayers and John Severin. First of all, from the angle, because the camera's down on the ground, but it's like, wow, we've never seen Doom look kind of that weak. He's usually standing there with his arms folded, you know, and whatever. But I really like, he's kind of like, almost like, don't hurt me. You know, he's not saying it, but the body position is saying it. It's really terrific.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you said, the camera's on the ground. It's kind of a Dutch angle. And you see Doom looking up at the Hulk. And, you know, again, these, you know, the facial expressions on this iron mask is incredible. Because, like you said, he's looking up at him, not with the usual defiance that you get from Dr. Doom, not the usual hubris or you know, the confidence. He's looking up at the Hulk, like you said, like, you know, don't hurt me anymore. Don't kill me. Because he knows that at this point, the Hulk could have killed him.
Yeah.
And for someone who says constantly, in this issue alone, how undefeatable he is, you know, this must be so humbling for Doom. And then all that is shown right there in that one panel.
Defeated by this idiot, right?
Yeah.
He's like, not, he's just the Hulk, you know, he's been out defeated by this moron, you know?
Right.
But yeah, and then it ends with the Hulk, of course, jumping away because he's like, he just wants to be far away and all alone. And of course, not going to last. But this is a really terrific little two-parter. I have to say, again, as a treasury, you said it sort of falls in between being one of those greatest hit sample ladders or a trade paperback. But in terms of just finding some old Hulk stories that had come and gone off the newsstand by this point, they found two good two-parters to put, you know, put between these covers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would not have, if I had spent my, you know, $1975, my 1975 $2 at, you know, I would not have felt disappointed by this. This is, I really could see this being a book that I probably would have read and reread and reread, just because, you know, they're good stories. You know, I don't want to faint it with, I don't want to damn it with faint praise, but you know, it's better than they needed to be in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, these could have been very easily just one issue kind of throwaway stories, but they're more than that. And I really kind of, and especially the second story, because yeah. There's so much going on and so many different characters, and you get kind of an insight into these characters, and it's really great. And it's not only a good Hulk story, it's a really good Doom story, I think.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Again, it's aided immeasurably by the artwork, but I thought this was a really terrific little two-parter. I enjoyed it quite a bit. So mm-hmm. Then we have one other bonus feature, which is a pinup gallery, which they talk about are culled from originally from Marvel British magazines. So we've got some pieces here. We've got one by Ron Wilson and Frank Giacoya, another one by Dave Hunt and Frank Giacoya, and then one by two by Pablo Marcus. What do you think of these pinups?
You know, I like them. The Ron Wilson and the Dave Hunt are okay. The Dave Hunt, the perspective seems a little weird, like because it's an image of what's his name, Jim Wilson, I think.
Jim Wilson, yeah.
Laying on the ground, and the Hulk is raising his fist at the Rhino, who's charging at him, but the Rhino kind of seems like he's sliding sideways in a weird way, you know, and it's just a red background. You know, it that one seems a little off, and the first one is okay, even though I don't understand how tanks could get that close to each other. But the Pablo Marcos ones, I really, really like, actually. I like those a lot.
His Hulk is really scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he looks like the brute that everyone says he is. I mean, he is heavily muscled. His hair looks a little longer and a little wilder mm-hmm. than it does in other depictions. And there is an element of danger, I guess, that you don't normally get from a Hulk comic. The first one, he looks like he's kind of fighting, you know, mutant monkey men, I guess, who are look probably about his size, but he's got his foot on one of them on the ground. He's lifting two up by each hand, you know, and they've got these fangs and then claws, and there's a human being kind of crouching, you know, behind the Hulk, and it looks really good. It looks like it's got kind of like a King Kong element, because there's these like this wooden fence, the staked fence. But this image really makes me want to read that story.
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. It's like, what the hell is that? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. He always did. And his Hulk is particularly like super ripped.
Yeah.
Super duper ripped. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It makes it kind of like, yeah, what are these stories? So it's a nice little bonus feature to throw in when they're like, we've got four extra pages. Again, I'm going to complain. There's a cover gallery, but it's on the inside back cover, and they're just reproduced in small black and white. Why?
Right.
The treasuries are so against that. I don't know. They had four pages. You could have done each cover, but they don't. But okay. You know, that's okay. I mean, the British stuff was impossible to find back then, unless you lived in England. So it's a nice little,
right.
Nice little throwaway, not throwaway, nice little bonus feature for your, you know, for your $2.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen that Monster and the Madman cover in color and at a bigger size.
Yep.
Because that is a heck of a cover. That's, you know, the Hulk is gripping Doom by the wrist, and he's kind of wound back for a punch, and Doom is blasting him with his gauntlet. It looks really good. I mean, it looks. You know, like you're saying, I wish they had done it in a different format, because I would love to see that at a bigger size and in color.
Yeah, totally. So, that's Marvel Treasury Edition number 20. Overall, I think it's a solid collection of Hulk stories. It's the kind of thing that you would not have been able to get in 1979. You know, those issues had come and gone. So they don't hang together thematically in any real way. I mean, again, you've got two-parters, but that's fine. You know, not everything has to be, like we mentioned, like a trade paperback. So, and again, especially the Dr. Doom story is a lot of fun, and it makes sense why you would put him on the cover, because that's the no offense to Cyborg. It's really Dr. Doom that's going to help sell this. So it's a nice little Hulk treasury.
Right. What did you think of the back cover?
It's fine. It's okay. I mean, it's nice to see the Abomination looking a little off model, I have to say. And then all these aliens. It's fine.
Right.
It's Hulk from the back, which is kind of a weird thing. I believe it's Budiansky and Abel as well. I don't know. What did you think of it?
It's fine. I thought it was interesting that they decided to show the Hulk from the back, which is different. I don't know that it works.
Normally don't do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that it necessarily works. But what I did like about it was the color. I think the colors really pop. And I think that helps that, that kind of helps balance out the things that don't quite work about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. Very coloring book kind of thing, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So overall, it's a nice little book. Max, thank you once again for coming back on the show and talking with me about this. Again, I wanted to get as many Hulks in before we shutter the doors here at Treasury Cast. So thank you so much for coming back.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's always a pleasure.
What do you have planned for the network? What are you working on?
Well, I have actually recorded something for the Mirror Factory, which is the literary podcast that I say I do, and I am going to start putting together some Human Fly episodes, and that's what's on the agenda for now.
Very cool.
Yeah, so you know, yeah, keep an eye out for that.
Absolutely. I love Mirror Factory. I'm very happy. I'm learning this just like you are, folks. I'm very happy to know that it's coming back. And I've said this before on other shows, and it's worth repeating. No joke, it was my appearance on the Mirror Factory that helped me land the woman that is now my wife, that I am now living with in Florida. So thanks to you, Max. You played matchmaker there with my appearance on the Mirror Factory. So I will always owe you and the show for that.
Wow. Well, see, where do you go from there?
I don't know. We'll have to work that out off air. I can pay you back or something. But yes, absolutely. I'm just glad I didn't embarrass myself on the show and, you know, kill the thing before it ever got started. So, anyway, Max, again, thank you so much for coming back. I mean, I love having you on the show. Whatever show I'm doing, I love having you on. So, and this was great fun rereading these old Hulk stories. It was really a blast. So, and thank you all for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Welcome, one and all, to the Fire and Water Racetrack and Arena. Please direct your attention to the center of the track, where you will see 36 buses lined up between two ramps, a tank full of live man-eating sharks, and a high wire stretching over it all. The rocket cycle is warmed up and all the nets have been removed. Who would attempt these stunts just to entertain and inspire his audience? What kind of man? What kind of hero? There, coming in on a rocket-powered skateboard, it's the death-defying Human Fly Cast! Join me, Max Romero, and a rotating roster of guests as we dive headfirst into the colorful comics of Marvel's The Human Fly. The death-defying Human Fly Cast is a limited episode podcast spotlighting the adventures of a man who comes back from a crippling auto accident to become a mysteriously masked stuntman with a mission to inspire others to never give up hope. We'll also talk about the real-life Human Fly, a daredevil with a murky past and a desire to be the best stuntman in history, until the day he just disappeared. The actual Human Fly would vanish as suddenly as he had materialized, but not before sparking a comic series featuring what would be the wildest superhero ever. Because he was real. It's gonna be wild.
explore the Hyborian Age and tread the jeweled thrones of Earth with me, Stephen Orr, and the Hither Came Conan podcast. Together, we'll take a look at the adventures of Conan of Cimmeria, the black-haired, sullen-eyed barbarian, one comic book issue at a time. From the Marvel comic series that began in 1970 to the currently being published series from Titan Comics and everything in between. Get Hither Came Conan now on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get podcasts.
And it's time for listener feedback. And these are the comments we got on Treasure Cast episode 90, where we talked about famous first edition Detective Comics number 27 with my pal Dan Greenfield. First up is Edo Boznar, who says, always a treat when Dan is a guest on Treasury Cast talking about Batman. And yes, I so remember that story he mentioned from the late 1960s that is an homage to the original Chemical Syndicate story, The Cry of the Night is Sudden Death. That last panel he mentioned, with both Robin and the other teenager noting that they have, quote, some heavy thinking to do, unquote, is etched into my memory for some reason. It was reprinted in Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest number 2, the one with the same cover as Limited Collector's Edition number C44. And for some reason, it's the story from that book that sticks in my memory the most. Well, that and the Joker's five-way revenge. Otherwise, looking over your gallery, I have to say that I really like the art from the plainclothes Pete feature. And Rob, hate to be that guy. Don't be that guy then, Ado. But on the topic of Superman's dominance of Action Comics covers, besides those early issues, there was also the brief period when it became Action Comics Weekly in the late 60s and Superman hardly appeared on the covers at all. Yeah, you know, I bought Action Comics at the time. I remember that. I always think I always had a slight issue that Superman didn't appear on the cover somewhere. I guess I was more trying to focus on how fast the editors of Action versus the editors of Detective knew who their star was. That it took, I think it took Batman a little longer to get the covers permanently than it did Superman. I could be wrong, but that's sort of what I was thinking about, is that they were, you know, it's 1939, 1940, and the two editors are like, whoa, wait a minute, what do we got here? We don't need to put Crimson Avenger on the cover when we have Batman. Mike Thomas says, great discussion. Dan is always a very engaging and informative guest. Like Dan, I always find it fascinating at the end when it says that Bruce Wayne went back to his quote-unquote room. I guess he wasn't living in Stately Wayne Manor. By the way, I had never had Detective Comics number 27 Treasury, but since Treasury Cast is ending soon, I always wanted to mention that one of my favorite early memories is receiving the Batman number 1 Treasury as an Easter present when I was very young. I think it was the first comic book I ever owned. My mom knew that I loved Batman from the Adam West series and Super Friends, so she must have told the Easter Bunny to get that issue for me. Although it was almost 50 years ago, I still remember reading that issue for the first time that day and learning about the Batman's origin and seeing the scary-looking Joker. I didn't discover Treasury Cast until after you and Dan covered the Batman number 1 Treasury, but I've gone back and listened to the episode more than once in the last few years, and it's a very fun listen, as this week's coverage of Detective Comics 27's Treasury was. Well, thank you so much, Mike. Chris Franklin from this very network says, that bright red light you see is me blushing all the way over here in Kentucky. Thanks so much for the kind words, fellas. As mentioned in a 13th Dimension article I wrote about first appearance Batman figures, my first exposure to Detective 27's Batman was in an Oreo giveaway comic that reprinted that story and cover along with the first Robin story from number 38 and the first Joker tale from Batman number 1. Years later, I snagged a copy of this comic and got to read the rest of the contents. Like you guys, none of it completely wowed me beyond historical significance, although I did find fun to witness early Crimson Avenger and Slam Bradley. I think one thing that held back the Crimson Avenger from being a big character like Batman was his nature as essentially a Green Hornet clone. Green Hornet was a huge radio hit, and Jim Chambers and whoever else contributed to the Avengers creation didn't veer away enough from their inspiration. Like the Green Hornet, CA was a crusading newspaper publisher, wore a fedora and a cloak slash trench coat, used a gas gun, and had an Asian valet slash sidekick. Now, in fairness, Batman wasn't wholly original either. This first story has now been cited as being heavily based on a previously published Shadow pulp story. But the mixture of various influences was unique, and the character, of course, went on to have his own distinct mystique that then influenced other characters. I'm so glad Rob finally got a copy of the Raj Treasury facsimile. It was quite the drama in the FW Messenger group, let me tell you. At one point, I was ready to drive a copy to New Jersey. It's just nuts that you had such problems getting this comic. It's essentially a trade paperback in a different format. One of DC's first story collections. And it's Batman. How could a comic shop not order this? Mind-boggling. Yeah, that was it, Chris. As Siskoid will mention shortly in the comments, I definitely gave a very truncated view of the drama on the show. But yeah, I couldn't fathom that any comic store wouldn't at least just automatically order one copy of a $15 Batman book. I just, like, who is more popular than Batman at this point? Spider-Man? Like, that'd be the only other character I'd remotely think is that much of an automatic buy. So I just was shocked that there was, you already got me going again, that there was any store that would look at that book and go, no, we're not going to get it. I couldn't understand that. So anyway, Rob McCarthy says so many thoughts. Number one, the Batman reveal is probably an idea they took from the Scarlet Pimpernel novel. Two, is it a retcon which comes at Avenger a lot like Green Hornet? See above, Rob. Three, having read every Dr. Occult, Dr. Weird story, I say a lot of Joe Shuster drawings look like Superman. That's true. Four, the 80s Secret Origin was so good. I remember thinking, finally, everyone will love the Creeper. Sadly, not to be. Jeez, who wrote this, Ange? Bradley Glynn says, Rob and Dan, I enjoyed listening to this episode, especially the discussion about modern facsimile editions. I've been 100% on board with DC's getting fairly regular reprints of single issues on non-glossy paper, sometimes in a genre other than superheroes, is fun. It satisfies my modest collecting itch. The recent Batman Ra's al Ghul Treasury size facsimile was a treat. Rob, your tale of woe to trying to acquire a copy was surprising and disappointing. Glad it eventually worked out. Regarding Batman's first story in Detective 27, I was first exposed to it in the oversized Detective 627 within a year of getting into the hobby. I can still remember finding it in a spinner rack in a certain bookstore in my childhood hometown. Can someone clarify if Batman ever missed an issue of Detective from 27 to 626? Detective 627 was intended to celebrate the 600th appearance in the series, but it seems like that already happened in 626. I don't think there's ever been an issue of Detective that didn't have Batman in it in some capacity. I can't imagine what that issue would have been, Bradley. I mean, comic historians that are more knowledgeable than me may disagree, but I can't imagine that's a thing. Gene Popa says, another great episode. When Dan mentioned the original concept that Roy Thomas had for Secret Origins, featuring each hero in order that they were first presented, starting back in 38, it reminded me of something I read many years ago. Apparently, when Marv Wolfman pitched the idea for the post-crisis reboot of DC, he also wanted to present each character in chronological order. His suggestion was that in the week after the last issue of Crisis on Infinite Earths, Action Comics number one should come out with a revamped Superman. Detective number one would follow next week with Batman. Wonder Woman number one the week after that, and on until all the core books were out. Then, about 6 months after all this began, there would be Justice League number one. I told the Jeanette Kahn and Secure Dan I really liked this idea, but that the higher-ups at Warner Communications nixed it on the grounds that they would lose valuable rack space to Marvel by not publishing a full complement of books every month. I can understand that argument, but man, it would have been so great to see DC with a cohesive plan to reboot all the characters on a steady schedule rather than the piecemeal doling out we got instead. Yeah, I mean, I like it as a nerd, but that is an insane idea, and it's just so anti-commercial. I could see why it was scrapped. That said, yes, I think my big fault with Crisis, you know, 40 years on, is that the redoing of the universe after, as you say, was so piecemeal and so scattershot that it never really made any sense. If they had really just shaken the Etch-A-Sets and started over fresh from the first month after Crisis, it might have been more cohesive, but it really kind of wasn't. Dr. Ange, I just mentioned, says, great episode. I love seeing these odd strips and always intrigued to see which ones have stuck. I can remember first hearing about Slam Bradley in Detective 500, but I think he was shelled for a long time before getting resurgence. I heard, quote, Bruce Nelson, I thought dentist, but insurance salesman also works. As for the race straight, that was one I got as a kid and I actually loved it. Alas, it was lost somewhere along the way, so I definitely have it on my list of treasuries to buy. There is a reason that story is still selling today. It's great. And even blown up to treasury size, Adam's stuff is glorious. Completely true, Andrew. Andrew Leyland says, 100% with Dan, re-facsimile editions. I had no interest in the Doom Patrol or picking up an expensive trade of their earlier adventures. However, their first appearance at cover price, well, not 10 cents, but you know what I mean, with old ads and on newsprint, take my money. And I loved it. A great story. Having read it, I may drop money on a trade. And then my chance to own Amazing Spider-Man number one, Hulk number one, or Batman, you get the idea. But don't get me started on the people who slab facsimiles and charge a premium for them. I didn't know that was a thing, Andrew, slabbing facsimiles, and that's ridiculous. A Cisco, it says, from our network. Great episode. I was one of the people who received the ongoing frustration in finding a New Jersey copy of that Treasury facsimile, and that was a really abridged listener's dodged a bullet, but an entertaining one. I do admit, everybody, I put the guys through torture because I just would not shut up about this. But again, it was more than I was kind of what I just talked about earlier. I was more stunned that it was so hard for something that I thought would be so simple. It's that kind of thing. You know, the metaphor I use with the guys, and maybe it's not going to work here because I don't think it worked with them. It's like, you want to just do like you want to just do this little thing around the house, you know, like you want to, like, I don't know if you have a house and you have like a little corner on a wall that needs a little bit of paint, and you're like, oh, I'll just get the paint out. This will take 5 minutes. And then like, you get the paint and it's the wrong paint, and then you knock the paint bucket over onto the floor, and then you, like, it just metastasizes into this huge thing, and now your whole day has been eaten up by the seemingly meaningless simple task. And that's kind of what it was. It's just, I thought, oh, a Batman Treasury, every comic store will have that. I can walk in day of and buy it. And the fact that I could not just flummoxed me, and it frustrated me to no end. So yeah, I really did torture the guys, and in the interest of being somewhat entertaining, I really did give an abridged version. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Dan. Always nice to hear Dan on the show. 13th Dimension is a great site. Finally, Speed Saunders gets a treasury. He's an ace investigator after all. I mean, who else would have put together that the dead guy on the dock was strangled with no clues other than the wire wrapped around his neck? That's a fair play mystery. The other stories were a bit of a slog, and holy crap, that Fu Manchu story is racist. I mean, like, run for Florida school board racist. That hurts a lot more than it used to, Brett. And I know it was 85 years ago, but that's really rough. Overall, great episode. I enjoyed the conversation format. I like the idea of facsimile editions of old treasuries. Yes. I have not gotten the Ra's al Ghul one yet, as it was sold out of my LCS, so that's probably a good sign for more. Now, if they do Spider-Man versus the Hulk at the Winter Olympics, I'll be first in line. I hope these treasury facsimiles start showing up in regular bookstores too. I especially enjoyed Rob airing his grievances against this Jersey comic shop on his way out of town. Way to burn those bridges on your way down I-95, Rob. I don't care anymore. Bucky749 says, great episode, a wonderful guest as always. Thank you, Bucky. Randall says, love the discussion of this landmark issue. In the early 80s, I owned a copy of Detective 27 and Batman 1. I had to read that sentence multiple times in the comments before I fully understood that Randall was saying the originals. They were beautiful but restored. Several years later, I was hard up for cash and needed money to train for the CPA exam, so I sold both books. I'm glad I got my CPA, but I wish I still had those magazines. Holy fee-holies, Randall. I mean, that's great that you used it to improve your life, but wow. I can't even wrap my head around the idea of owning those two books. He continues, a couple of comments about Chemical Syndicate. One, Gordon allows a layman to go with him on a crime detail. Not very good policing there. Two, did you notice that the cover calls the character Batman, but the text calls him Bat-Man? Three, you mentioned the excessive word balloons, another story, and the fact that Batman doesn't talk in the story until the end. But when he does, boy, does he talk. That last panel, on the next last page, it contains a word balloon that is at least twice the size of Batman's head. And you mentioned the stereotype depiction of Asians and other stories in this magazine, similar to today's political fearmongering about Mexican immigrants. America experienced the same type of irrational fear concerning Asians in the late 1880s through the mid-20th century. Chinese immigration skyrocketed during this period, and much like the current environment, many Americans feared them because of the way Chinese looked and the types of jobs they accepted. This unfounded hatred led to racist stereotypes of this group of people. Yes, I am aware of the sort of overview of that history, and unfortunately, a lot of things don't seem to change. Gotham's Mansion says, my first comics purchases were in September, October 76. So the famous first edition predated this when I began collecting. My first exposure to Case of the Chemical Syndicate was in the Oreo reprint that Chris mentioned. I still remember pestering everyone I knew to get their Oreo Prusa purchase. I think we're spoiled now because we have access to reprints of so many comics from the past, not to mention being able to look up our favorite characters' histories online. As a lifelong Batman fan, I was thrilled to finally be able to read the first story back when I got the Oreo reprint and was shocked that Batman killed back then. I had never seen that. At first, I thought maybe I misread it when Batman tossed that dude off the roof. But nope, there was his dead body on the ground. Glad you mentioned how well Bill Finger was able to work his story into six pages, even though we did rip off the story from The Shadow. One thing I've noticed how I've read every Batman story from the 40s is how well-paced Finger's stories are. As much as I love the Bronze Age, many stories sometimes end abruptly because the writers seem to run out of room. On the replica of the Race Treasury, Rob, I'm sorry to hear, you had such a hard time getting one. Mine was delayed because of the comic shop I ordered didn't have a box big enough to ship them. Maybe the staff was so young and they didn't know what a treasury was. I have them in hand now, so no harm, no foul. The original Treasury is such a childhood favorite of mine that I bought the replica for myself and several more copies to give to gifts, friends as gifts. Well done. I do have the famous first edition Detective 27 Treasury now. Hey, I'm a 70s baby that I love the Treasuries. I'm not going to pass up any Batman Treasury, even if I did already have the 6 pages of Batman. Chuck Dill says, I really enjoyed this episode. It's always nice when you have Dan Greenfield on as a guest. I'm missing his Super Friends podcast. And I co-sign your thoughts on Chris Franklin starting a podcast about toys. He's my second favorite Fire and Water Network all-star. Who's the first? I have been doing a read-through of Golden Age Comics in one of my 4 reading streams. It's a whole thing with spreadsheets, too. Anyway, wow, Chuck. Anyway, I'm familiar with movie comics. At the moment, I've been through 5 of the 6 published. They are strange. Are you familiar with Fumetti? Yes, I am. That's essentially what they are, with pictures of the movie stars in action in the panels. Only, the artists have drawn outlines around the forms, and occasionally you'll get a hand-drawn panel mixed in for fun. There are some completely illustrated features, but the movie segments are all done with photos of the actors, like the recent John Byrne Star Trek books, only not nearly done as well. I'm not surprised that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster had a feature in Detective 27. If you look at DC's output up to that point, every creator team they had appeared in each of their 4 magazines. More Fun, Adventure, Detective, and Action all had Siegel and Shuster features. They were doing Radio Squad, Federal Men, Spy, and Slam Bradley. Heck, even Bob Kane was in Action Comics with Clip Carson, Adventure Comics with Rusty and his pals, and various single-page humor strips in all the books. Thank you, Chuck. I knew all that, but I don't know. I blanked when I said it, but yeah, really, DC, really, not that this is news, but their whole company was just built on the backs of about like a dozen guys. You know, it's just kind of amazing. And then finally, Martin Gray says, good on Dan for pointing out how great the current Batman miniseries is. I've especially enjoyed the characterization of Julie Madison in the first 2 issues, and I'm using that famous silhouette you mentioned on the cover of #1 as a great idea. So, Rob, if DC put out new editions of more of these, you say you would buy anything, even Superman Salutes the Bicentennial? Yes. Yes, I am saying that. I'll buy every one of these facsimile treasuries that DC puts out because I want them to put out more. So I'll buy the Rudolphs. Not that even the Rudolphs were all that bad now that we've talked about them. I'll buy any one, but yes, I will buy Superman Salutes the Bicentennial. I was going to say, I hope they don't update the president's back page because who needs that? Anyway, thanks so much, everybody, for the comments. I really appreciate it. A big thanks to fellow Network All-Star Max Romero for coming by and talking Hulk with me. That is always fun. For some reason, the Hulk treasuries were like, there were more of them left to do than like any other character, I guess because he got more. And so, therefore, there were more to do. You know, we only did a few, so I'm glad we get to catch up on them. So thanks so much to Max for coming by. I love talking to him. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Treasury Cast on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find us on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pullier, Brett Young, Mark Bulbus, and Chuck Dill, plus Gord Tolton and Davius Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I really appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
Always a pleasure to see you, Dr. Banner.
What do you want with us, Doom?
You, I most certainly don't want. Just your infamous temper. My neurotransmitter is creating a rage in you that only I control. The powerful military is no longer of consequence, for I control their mightiest foe, the Incredible Hulk.